ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A body on the train tracks in mysterious circumstances.
Mark's been found on railway tracks.
An award-winning ABC podcast and a fresh inquest underway.
Every time we walk out of that inquest, just being like, oh my God.
You weren't out there on the train tracks that night?
Absolutely not.
As the answers get closer, the podcast is back.
He said he's guilty. He's guilty as sin.
Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Secret meetings, geopolitical power plays, blackmail. It's the hit show on Netflix. We're talking about The Diplomat.
It has it all, some say. But if you were under the impression it was all purely fiction, look, think again.
So it turns out the show was inspired by a real person, one particular American ambassador and her husband.
And we're about to meet them both. I'm Geraldine Doogan.
This is a really exciting episode. I'm Hamish McDonald. This is Global Roaming. Well, welcome back, Geraldine Doogan.
Thank you. Yes, I am back. A short trip over to the UK, there at a very dramatic time, of course. The UK and Spain. I went to see Madrid for the first time in my life.
Unbelievable how much you pack into 6 days off.
Well, look, I decided like a lot of Australians, I know Barcelona, but I'd never been to Madrid. And so I went to Madrid and also the UK, which, of course, I just simply love.
And we've dropped, by the way, a bonus episode on all of the scandal unfolding at the BBC, which Geraldine is kind of intoxicated by.
I certainly was absorbed in it, shall we say. Yep. Certainly was.
So you can find that in your podcast feed. But we are talking about The Diplomat. Season 3 is streaming at the moment. People absolutely crazy for it, although not you entirely, Geraldine.
No, I mean, I'm not alone. I found the first series just a bit too Aaron Sorkin-ish, a bit too sort of glib. Yes, witty riposts sort of annoy me after a while, but I totally accept the brilliance of those two key actors and their interaction. I'm into the third series, but I wouldn't say I'm quite as fascinated as you are.
But for those of you that don't watch it, haven't seen it, or only sort of sampled it, it features Kate Wyler, who's the US ambassador to London. Hal, her husband, has also had a huge career in the US State Department. Fascinating marital dynamic. But I suppose the reason we're interested in it for Global Roaming, Geraldine, is that it foregrounds US diplomacy. It foregrounds the role that America can play on the world stage, but also the capacity of diplomats to act, shape events, and influence things.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I've been fascinated for years, and I'll say so towards the end with my recommendation about just what diplomacy can do, because I think it's grossly misunderstood that they sort of swan around with pink gins, you know. And
sometimes they do.
Well, sometimes they do, but the purpose is actually really to affect the order of events, the global order of events. It's really highly significant. It's much better than having armies traipse through to do this. That's the point.
I think the perception that we have of US diplomacy is that it has and it does overplay its hand from time to time.
Yeah.
And I think what we're going to explore in this episode is whether that, in fact, is the intention. You know, we often talk about the role of Australian diplomacy in this region. Sometimes I think when it goes wrong, you get perhaps smaller nation states complaining, reacting badly because we've been seen to strong arm. And certainly our relationship with near Asian neighbours has sometimes been fractious, in part because of comments like regional sheriff, you know, the John Howard claim.
Well, quite. But look at what's just happened between us and Indonesia.
Exactly.
I mean, this agreement to basically consult each other instantly if there's any sense of a threat. Now, that is, I think, extremely clever diplomacy. And, I mean, there's lots more to emerge about that. That's one of the more interesting developments of the recent times, I think.
Yeah, in part because we don't know what's included in the communique, in the document. I think, you know, this is a really interesting way of getting into the question of the effectiveness, the capacity of diplomacy to deliver, particularly in a moment when the US's role on the global stage is in question. You know, it's not just whether the world trusts and can work with America, it's whether America
wants to become transactional.
Well, whether they want to play that role. And, you know, part of it is Trump's desire to just have one-on-one relationships and hang everything on that. But clearly the world is a complex place and you need lots of players to be in on the deal to get the deal to deliver. And I guess the Middle East is a case in point of that. Well, would you like to introduce our guest slash guests?
Yes. Look, Ambassador Beth Jones is the woman we're going to meet, the real diplomat. She's been everywhere, frankly, Kabul, Cairo, Amman, Baghdad, West Berlin. She was Assistant Secretary for the Near East and the US Ambassador to Kazakhstan. And as you'll hear, she just really loved that role. She coordinated recently the Afghan relocation effort after the fall of Kabul. Now, I don't want to give away too much, but you might hear some similarities between Beth and Don and Kate and Hal, if you're familiar with the show.
So to set this up for you properly, Beth's husband, Don, is maybe or maybe not the inspiration for Hal. I guess we'll find out. But it was kind of hard to keep him away from this interview.
he was enjoying himself.
Well, Ambassador Elizabeth Jones, it's just delightful to meet you. Welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you. Glad to meet with you guys.
I mean, I need to ask you the question front up. Are you the inspiration for the diplomat? Are you Kate Wyler?
The showrunner, Deborah Kahn, says that that's the case, that Don and I are together, having met on Homeland when she was a writer there and we were unofficial consultants to Homeland.
Okay, so Don is Hal and you're Kate. Is it as explicit as that?
That I will stick my head in for no.
the critical word is inspiration as opposed to model Don.
Okay. And so do you recognize yourself in this series, The Diplomat, then, if you're the sort of inspiration and it's not quite that explicit?
What we do is we recognize some of the things that we've told them about. So, for instance, when Kate arrives in London without a Senate hearing, Deborah Kahn, the showrunner and creator, knew that that was possible because when I was in Pakistan and the ambassador, Arnie Rafel, was killed with President Zia in a terrible plane crash, I was the number two, and the ambassador coming in was told by the Senate, this is such a crisis, you go, you be sworn in Pakistan, we'll do a hearing for you in 6 months after things have calmed down. So she knew that it was possible to do it that way. So I swore in the ambassador in his office in Islamabad.
We're talking to you at such an interesting moment because I guess the validity, the capacity of diplomacy to deliver is being questioned even by the US president. So I want to hear a little bit about your actual career as well. And your parents were both in the Foreign Service. And it wasn't, I think we might just need to deal with that buzz,
yeah,
whatever that
sorry,
is.
It's,
Can
it's,
I be a Hal here for a second? One thing I want to add to what Beth just said about the connection to Homeland was that Beth was the golden ticket. Because when Deborah contacted her, the connection was basically to all of her colleagues as well. And to hear Deborah tell it, she said, who else can I talk to? And within a day, her inbox on her email was jammed with all sorts of...
It's my computer that's dinging. Somebody is texting me and I've told them to stop texting me.
I've got to tell you, with the pings going and Don chiming in, I'm getting very Kate and Hal vibes from the whole setup.
This is Schrodinger's cat.
Ambassador Beth Jones, going into diplomacy wasn't your first career choice, was it?
No. At first, I thought I should be in the Peace Corps. But I didn't really like what the Peace Corps was offering me. This is straight out of university. And I was talking to my father about it, who was a Foreign Service officer. And he said, well, why don't you just treat the Foreign Service as the Peace Corps? Just go in for 2 years and see how you like it. Because in the meantime, I had passed the Foreign Service exam. So I did go in for 2 years. And 40 years later, I still loved it.
Your first ever posting was to Kabul, which must have been pretty extraordinary. That's a place I've spent a lot of time, a country that I love, Afghanistan. When were you there? What was it like?
I got there in January of 1971. The king, Zahir Shah, was still in charge. There was a tremendous amount of discussion about his corruption and how poor people in Afghanistan were, especially in the north. It was also a time that there was a very large USAID and Peace Corps program in Afghanistan. And the Peace Corps and the USAID came together during a famine to come up with what we call the Work for Wheat program. You may have been there probably later. But that was a very big, important program. One of the things I learned, I was a little concerned about being a woman in Afghanistan, a very, very conservative country, as you know, for women. And I dressed depending on what I thought was going to happen in the day. So sometimes I wore Western dress, i.e., those were miniskirt days. But I was a little concerned one day when my boss told me to go to the local police station because an American citizen had been arrested, and I was supposed to go and get him out. And I thought, okay, well, I was in a miniskirt that day, and I thought, oh, how am I going to do this? But I marched myself in there, went to the chief police officer and said I was a vice consul from the American embassy, and Mr. whatever his name was an American citizen, and I needed to have him out, and I needed to take him with me. And he just looked at me and he said, which embassy did you say? And I said, the American embassy. He said, okay. And that was my first lesson in, they saw me not as male or female, but as American embassy official. So that helped me a lot with my self-confidence and how to get around.
So Beth, you mentioned earlier an incident that happened in Pakistan just after you'd arrived as deputy chief of mission back in 88. Can you tell me a little bit more about what actually happened?
Within 2 weeks, very unfortunately, there was a terrible plane crash with President Zia-ul-Haq, the U.S. ambassador, and the chief of the U.S. Embassy's military assistance program. I'd been there only 2 weeks. I got the call. I hyperventilated because it was just such a shock. I must say what went through my head first is, oh my God, my friend Arnie's been killed. And then the very next thing was, President Zia's been killed. Are there tanks in the street? And the third was, if there are tanks in the street, or no matter what the reason for this is, are the kids in the American schools safe? And we need to have an emergency action committee meeting instantly to try to sort out what in the world has happened and what we need to do next.
I'm curious, though, what this meant for you in a professional capacity in a moment like that, in a country like Pakistan, with the relationship it had with the United States. The president dies, the US ambassador dies. Normally in a circumstance like this, the US might have a very big role to play. Were you immediately aware of what influence was resting on your shoulders in that moment?
I was. The ambassador, Arnie Raifel, had in the 2 weeks that I was there with him, had introduced me to absolutely everybody that I needed to know, whether it was the heads of each of the governorates of Pakistan, the head of the army, and tons of people in the government, as well as the parliament. So I knew instantly who to call. President Zia's chief of staff ended up being a good colleague, but I knew him well enough to call him right away. What I needed to do, though, was make sure that the embassy understood that I was somebody who they could rely on. And I thought, I've only been here 2 weeks. They don't know me at all. I know what to do in a crisis like this because I've been in plenty of other crises before. And it dawned on me as I was walking to the room where we were going to have the Emergency Action Committee meeting with the entire staff. The one thing they know is that Arnie Raifel chose me, and they loved the ambassador, Arnie Raifel. So I thought, okay, they know. I feel like I'm good now, and I could just go through a list that I'd made up in the previous 10 minutes of the things we needed to think about in terms of our own safety, in terms of welcoming the Secretary of State, who was going to be coming right away. The new ambassador was going to be coming on the plane. That was all decided that one night. I had to find the ambassador's widow. She was not in Islamabad. She was in Karachi. I had to find her and tell her what had happened before her kids and his kids heard it on the news in California. So it was things like that that I found that I had to do.
Rightly or wrongly, there's a perception that the US tries to manipulate events and politics in foreign countries. And that's the precise kind of moment where the US is accused of those sorts of things. How do you identify the right, point between being helpful, maybe influencing positive outcomes, but not overplaying your hand and manipulating events? Or do you just manipulate events? Is that the objective for America?
What I found to be the very best posture for us, especially when we were advocating policies and behavior changes, was to work in a consortium of some kind, not just the U.S. going in finger wagging, but getting together with like-minded countries to agree on what the set of objectives should be for a particular thing, whether particularly, it was particularly important when we were in, when I was ambassador in Kazakhstan, right after the breakup of the Soviet Union. That's where Don and I met. And that I found worked really much better than just me going in on my own to try to get something done. If I could go in with the French, the British, the Australians, the Dutch, the Japanese, and the Germans, it was a much better case that we could make.
I know you're a seasoned diplomat, so I'm just going to observe that you didn't really answer my question about whether you're being helpful or whether you're trying to manipulate events.
Okay. So are we trying to manipulate? Yes, we are. But this, what I was talking about was the style in which I find it most useful to do that. We are working on changing behavior. That's the whole point of all the advocacy work that we do. That's all the work that USAID has been doing and Don and his colleagues who were experts working for USAID were extremely welcome and were very powerful in the sense that because we, the U.S., the other great power, the only, you know, the Kazakhstanis knew the Soviets and they knew about us, they didn't know us, but they assumed that we would be as dictatorial and condescending as the Soviets had been to them. And yet Don and his colleagues would go and say, economic reform, for example, for a banking system, this is the way it's done in Europe. This is the way it's done in the US. This is the way it's done in Chile. This is the way it's done in South Africa, whatever the options the experts had. You know your country, you're in charge of your country, you choose. And for them, this was a novel experience to be treated as equals by all of us. And be told that they're in charge of their country and we'd be happy to help them implement whichever choice they made on what made the most sense in their terms on various economic reform issues.
This is ABC Radio National's Global Roaming, and you're listening to a fascinating chat that Hamish had earlier this week with the real ambassador who inspired the hit Netflix show, The Diplomat.
I do not want to go past the fact that you are a woman serving in these roles in places like Egypt, Afghanistan, Pakistan. Was it a help? Was it a hindrance? Did it get you access in a way that maybe a male wouldn't get access?
I found it a big help. It got me access in Egypt when I was working on the Kissinger shuttle diplomacy and having to go all over the place all the time. I could get into any ministry or any airfield because they would say, oh, Elizabeth, how are you? Ahlan wa sahlan, come on in. And the men behind me would all have to show their ID cards and maybe get in or maybe not. But the other thing I found too, of course, one of the things we do is we spend a lot of time talking to people and finding venues in which we can talk to a number of people and listen, ask questions and listen to what they have to say. And I found in Muslim countries, I mean, frankly, it's the same thing in the U.S., men gather in one part of the living room and the women in the other. Well, I could go to both parts. And I found that the women were better political gossips than the men were. And I got more reporting cables out of the women usually than I did out of the men.
Not that you want to make any broad insinuations about women gossiping, obviously, Beth.
Well, it was
collection.
It was collection. It was political gossip. You know, who's in, who's out on the senior ministers, the military, who's about to be the chief of army staff, et cetera. That was all important stuff.
Okay. So I want to turn to Kazakhstan. That's your first appointment as ambassador, 1994. This is not long after the fall of the Soviet Union. Now, I want to clarify, Hal, I want to clarify, Don, I'm very sorry.
Oh, my God.
Don, I want to clarify, yes. Don, is this where you come into the picture? Is it at that time that you guys meet? How did you meet? How do you come together?
The Soviet Union falls apart. We're in a situation where we're trying to fill a big void. Here's an opportunity for us to go into these republics as they try to rebuild themselves. Can we influence the way they do that and move them from a command economy into a demand economy? We knew that we had had that opportunity sort of early in the process in Poland, and frankly, we screwed it up. So the U.S. is looking for ways to do this. So I got a call. They had designed a program that was largely targeted towards public health and pharmaceutical products. The Soviets and their central pharmacy, they had almost no contact with the outside world. They made all their own pharmaceuticals, and it all fell apart. They didn't have any drugs. They couldn't even, you know, they had no pharmacies. It was a central pharmacy. So our effort was to, okay, how can we connect this part of what was the government with the Western world and make a market for pharmaceutical products? I went for what was supposed to be 2 or 3 months, and I wound up staying almost 5 years. There were a boatload of us that had similar stories. It was like, whoa, this is kind of cool. We don't get to work in the evil empire, the collapse of the evil empire all that often.
Including some of the business people. They would come and you know, sign a project agreement, thinking they'd be there for a couple of days, and they'd be there for a year because not least because implementation was hard as hell. Well, the signing the agreement was a cinch compared to what it was to implement it.
Right. And it was the post agreement signing negotiation that was always really interesting. So in that process, Beth was basically my client. You know, he was the head of the embassy.
Beth, I'm really interested in the idea of this being kind of a moment, a high point for diplomacy. A real feature of the series, The Diplomat, is that there seems to be this direct line between the ambassador and the White House. Is that how it works in practice, you know, for American diplomats?
Not really. Here's how, there are a couple of elements to this. One is that I, as an ambassador overseas, you work for the State Department, and Secretary Colin Powell was very insistent on that. He didn't want his ambassadors to be going to the National Security Advisor without going through him first. And he made that very clear, especially to the ambassador in our ambassador in Russia.
So this was saying, he was saying, don't call John Bolton directly. Is that how we interpret
this? It's Sandy Rice.
Okay. Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. So my relationship would be with the State Department, but I could also be in touch with the National Security Advisor staff, who, you know, the people who are responsible for the region. And one of the reasons that made Kazakhstan so special is that I took the attitude that they hired me to take care of business out there. They didn't want me to be in touch with Washington really at all very much. And I certainly didn't want to be in touch with Washington very much. I didn't need to be in touch with Washington because we thought we could figure it out much better on our own out there with the fabulous group of people who happened to be assigned there.
If I may, on top of that was, okay, you're the embassy. You actually do have the ability to have communications with Washington. None of the rest of us did. We physically and technologically, it didn't work. So in many respects, Beth was in the region and some of her colleagues from the other countries and embassies would say, well, you know, this is bad. We don't like this because we can't be in touch with Washington. And Beth's going, why do you want to be in touch with Washington?
you don't want them to tell us what to do.
We have to do this on our own.
But
so you could take advantage of that distance in a sense.
The 11-hour time change was heaven for me.
You sound awfully like foreign correspondents because when you're deployed as a foreign correspondent and you're in a different time zone, you don't have to talk to your editor because you just need to get the story done. And you can say, sorry, it's too late. We did the story. And if you really want to skirt around them, you call the other news desk on the other side of the world that you know is not going to be awake when they get up in the morning and circumvent it this way. Maybe the same tactics apply.
I think so.
You are sounding rather like Kate Wyler, it's got to be said, asking for forgiveness rather than permission.
Absolutely. No question.
One of the things that you've left out of this equation is, I know you've gone through her various posts and where she's been. Coming from the outside and watching this through Abe's eyes and through others, one of the big differentiations is between hardship posts and non-hardship posts. Mostly non-hardship posts are the ones that are staffed by political appointees. And in many respects, having that relationship, that moneyed relationship with the president is good. You are the president's representative in that country, and to be able to say that and have that connection.
We don't have a U.S. ambassador here in Australia at the moment. Anyone you think the president should send our way?
I don't know. I thought Caroline Kennedy was pretty cool.
Well, she's long gone, and I think she may be out of favor with the Trumps.
I know. I'm sorry.
That's an unfair question, because when you look at any of the ambassadors that he appoints, you sort of go like, no.
I mean, I have zero clue about the people around Trump, other than, you know, what I read in the paper.
When I look around the world today, and we often talk to foreign leaders here on Global Roaming, you see that American diplomacy has really fallen out of favor on the world stage. But also we can all observe that it's fallen out of favor in Washington as well with the Trump administration.
Yeah.
Do you see this as a personal repudiation of what you've worked for, of what you've achieved, good or bad?
Well, first, I mean, there's no question that it's very painful for all of us. There's no question about that. And it's extremely painful for all the people, all of my colleagues and the State Department who've been fired and the subject of reduction in force. So that's one. The fact, as you mentioned, that the U.S. is no longer a leader in the world is also very painful. But at the same time, I have a strong conviction that all of the work that all of us did all those years with all of our colleagues around other embassies and in other foreign ministries must stick in terms of why it's important to stick together, to form coalitions, to take the lead, to form a coalition or a group or a like-minded group on particular issues, and take the place of the U.S. It doesn't have to be the same country doing all of it, but you know, some countries can take the lead on climate change, another country can take the lead on disarmament, another country can take a lead on oceans. I mean, whatever it all is. But
for countries like Australia, this is actually an important moment. There's an opportunity here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know the habit's there. It has to be there. I've known so many colleagues in other foreign ministries who were just brilliant diplomats. They know how to do this, and they could see us. They could see what we did to take the lead.
Well, Australians among those,
absolutely.
Before we get totally caught up, one of the things that I know you support completely, we haven't talked about much, is the role of our intelligence agencies and their staff, and how they have, in fact, in many instances, stepped up.
Yeah,
and I've seen that. I'm a contractor. I've done a fair amount of work in places where the agency had serious roles, and they've been filling in some of these gaps that we're getting because of the rifts of foreign service officers. Mm. And Beth was particularly hit by it. One of the last big jobs she had was having to do with resettlement of Afghan refugees that we'd left behind. And that entire operation was cut completely. We just said, bye-bye, we're out of here. And a lot of that has been at least attempted to be filled by other organizations.
I had always very good conversations with my Australian colleague on taking Afghans. So I'm very grateful for that. Plus, the Australian ambassador to Kazakhstan was a great pal of ours. He was one of the people I consulted with regularly on what's the best way to go about doing this, that, or the other thing. His Russian was brilliant. And he became a very, very senior ambassador in the Australian system.
Final thought, favorite posting?
Ooh.
Careful.
Kazakhstan, because it was so unique.
No.
You told our producer a different answer. Never mind.
That's a good.
But it was really unique because we were making it up so much as we went along. And we did so well with the Kazakhstanis in terms of what they wanted, what they needed. But I must say Cairo for me was a favorite, just because that was also unique. Coming from no diplomatic relations to a fabulous relationship with the Egyptians, not least because of the Kissinger shuttle diplomacy and then the relationships that we were able to build up with Sadat's trip to Jerusalem. I was in Jordan when that happened. That was huge. And there was a tremendous amount of really good work done there and would have continued had Rabin not been assassinated.
Wasn't there one particular phone call that sort of became your favorite dinner party conversation?
Yes. Yeah. Wow. This This was when I was an S1. It was during the Kissinger shuttle diplomacy. We were fairly far along. It was toward the end of the negotiations, and we were an S1 because that's where Sadat liked to be in the winter. Kissinger was away. He was in Jerusalem negotiating with Golda Meir. So the very few of us that were in this little group of U.S. officials in this hotel in S1. The American delegation, when they were there, had the fifth floor. So the few of us who were there were on the fifth floor. The fourth floor was reserved for all the journalists who came with Kissinger. And the third floor was reserved for the Egyptian foreign minister and his staff, the Egyptian officials. So there we are waiting for Kissinger to come back. And we don't know what's going on. But suddenly the phone rings in the little office that we have in the hotel on the fifth floor. And it's a political officer in Cairo who says, Beth, I've got it. I've got an immediate cable that I need to dictate to you. These are Golda Meir's final offers on the negotiation for the Sinai, for kilometer 101 in the Sinai.
And implied is there's no secure communications here. This is an open phone line.
This is an open phone line. It's very difficult to hear. I'm yelling over the phone. Arthur Houghton on the other end is shouting. I keep repeating what he's saying as I write it down to make sure I've got it right. The cable was labeled secret, no distribution, you know, personal only between the secretary and the ambassador. So I hand the piece of paper to Ambassador Iles to go down to the third floor to present, to make this presentation to the Egyptian foreign minister when there's a knock on the door of our little office. And I say, come in. And the Egyptian foreign minister walks in with a big grin on his face and says, we accept. They've heard the whole thing on the phone.
Of course.
They've been listening to it. So it's a good thing that I kept repeating everything to make sure they got it right too.
Don, Ambassador Beth Jones, shukran jazilan.
Afghan.
Geraldine, your reflections.
Her sheer exuberance about the work she had done was quite intoxicating. I think, to use your word, I thought it was very interesting the way she talked about diplomacy done as a consortium and the strength of doing it not just solo. Now, I thought that was very good to hear from a US diplomat, to be quite honest, and she was quite persuasive about that. Mm. And her acceptance that they did try to influence the actual course of events. Yes, they were trying to influence behaviour.
I thought she was pretty candid about that.
Yeah,
to be honest,
I did too.
In describing it in that particular way. And of course, you know, there is a flip side to that. Not everyone welcomes the way America has played its hand.
No, they don't. But I felt the way she described, and I have heard other very good diplomats like the late Alan Gingell, and he said there are times when you have to speak sternly. And she basically said that they described, well, this is how it's done in various different ways. You have to call on your own culture to work out what choices you wish to make. And that's a pretty blunt way of describing it, but it does leave the choice to the people concerned.
There is something very American, though, I think, about the underlying attitude that we heard from Beth, which is this sort of unyielding sense of...
We know the best way.
Well, that we really believe that what we're doing is good and right.
Yeah, there's no doubt that's there. And they very rarely openly accept this will be good for us too, usually American business.
So, recommendations, Jerry?
Look, I'm going to recommend a mini-series that we did on Saturday Extra back in 2021, it turns out, which featured interviews with five former diplomats, John McCarthy from Australia, Sue Boyd from Australia, Jeff Raby from Australia, the US Consul General Sharon Hudson-Dean, and the late Martin Indyk, who was a great diplomat. We're going to put it up and you might like to listen to it. People who've really been on the ground, certainly not quite in the Kate Weiler mould, I don't suppose, but I think you could find that very interesting.
I'm going to recommend something on the Australia-Indonesia arrangement, diplomatic success story that you were talking about earlier. Natalie Sambi's written a piece for the Lowy Interpreter. I'm going to recommend that. There's still more to come on it, of course, but I think she's interesting for her perspective on how this might also be received by other Southeast Asian nations.
Now, you're going to Indonesia next year, aren't you?
I am, yes. We'll be there, I think, around March of next year, Global Roaming. We'll be roaming. You want to come?
Well, I might. I'd love to, actually.
We should ask the bosses.
Yes, I know. We absolutely should. No, I love going to Indonesia. So it'll be very interesting because I think it's actually being signed in January, isn't it?
I don't know the date precisely, but I know our Prime Minister is due to go early next year to sign it with Prabowo.
So that is all still to come in 2026.
Global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address. Please keep the correspondence coming. And if you want to hear our bonus episode on the BBC scandal, look for it in your podcast feed.
And thanks to our producer, Taryn Priyadko. Bye-bye, Hamish.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.